And the lecturer, so I hope it's kind of reasonably within time. So,
Yes, and thank you
but
for agreeing
have a
to be with us today, because it's really fantastic lecture that you are giving, and very interesting. So I think it's a lot of nice details.
yeah.
Test, test, test. It's working. Can you say something, Jens Peter? I'm just checking
Yes,
streaming.
I can say something. I'm also audible on the stream. So, is it audible on the stream also?
Yeah, so
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3.
everything is working, Jens Peter. So we are good to go. Hello, everyone who are attending us on Zoom today, in the class, also in streaming. It will be a guest lecture from Jens Peter Sandvik. Jens Peter is a part-time PhD student at our Department of Information Security Communication Technology, and also Jens Peter working in Kripos. So, Jens Peter, please, the floor is yours.
Ah, thank you. So I'm Jens Peter Sandvik, as Andrea mentioned, working in Kripos. I'm a part-time PhD student trying to finish my last papers and and my PhD now. So this lecture is about mobile and embedded system forensics, something I wrote about in textbook. Here's some short overview of the lecture. First, a short introduction, a little bit about embedded systems, mobile phones, and consumer electronics. Then we go a little bit into mobile phones and talk about the collection of data, short on the examination of the data, and a short wrap-up at the end. So, first, I have to say that not all slides are my own. I have stolen some from Stefan Axelsson when he had this lecture. So I thought they were quite good. So I borrowed some of his lecture notes. Today, everyone has a mobile phone, and not only that, everyone has a mobile phone, but they also everyone. Or almost everyone owns some type of embedded computing system. Embedded systems are everywhere. You can find them in places you, like a few years ago, wouldn't believe would be, and might still not believe that they're there. You have them in fridges, in washing machines, everywhere you can find computing power today. When you look at Internet of Things devices, that's kind of a trending topic, and also can they are also some type of embedded system. It's a built-in system. They say it's kind of estimates say that it would be about 13.1 billion devices this year, and about 29 billion. Systems by 2030, or devices by 2030, according to Statista. But of course, the estimates vary widely between reports and papers. So one thing, like kind of to make the thoughts start going, we can think about which small devices do we use or interact with daily. We have everything from like when I'm coming to work, I have to use my card to get into work. So you have door access systems, you have alarm systems, we have our phone. We have a lot of application we use for our daily routine. For example, traveling, our tickets are on the phones, and so on. We are recorded by a huge number of surveillance cameras around, and and base stations will pick up our signals from the phone, and Wi-Fi access points pick up our Wi-Fi signals. So it's kind of like we leave digital traces almost everywhere. And from a forensic point of view, it's kind of like it is both this to figure out where data might be that can help us in our investigation, but also kind of how to get that information. Yeah, what is a mobile phone or embedded system? It's basically you have a central processing unit or maybe several processing units. You have some random access memory. Typically, embedded system also contains some non-volatile storage. You have some peripherals, and more often than not, you have a user interface, one or several user interfaces. And it's kind of, when thinking about it this way, it's in many ways just like another computer system. So when they are so similar, what is the difference? As said, embedded systems are like a normal computer, but they often have stricter constraints on their memory, storage, amount of storage, their processing power they can use, the power consumption that they can use. I mean, they have the constraints on the chips themselves for processing power. So they are typically chips with low processing power. And they are often used in real-time systems, either a soft real-time system or a hard one. The difference is kind of that in a hard real-time system, you have hard limits for when a task needs to be finished, while in a soft, it's kind of best effort. You can have a limited keyboard, maybe just a few buttons or a touch screen. You can have a screen, status lights, or sensors rather than a full kind of computer user interface. So it's kind of the way you get data into the system and out of the system might be very different from a computer system. Many smaller systems are so-called system on a chip, with where both the CPU, the memory, peripheral controller, even some sensors are on one microchip or on one die. So that makes it much kind of save much more time, space saving, and also some saving on the power consumption when everything is so close to each other. Yeah, embedded systems, like typically microcontrollers like used in embedded system is, for example, this Atmel AVR that is in Arduino systems. And the interesting thing is that this AVR architecture was kind of invented by students here at what was at that time called NTH, but now it's NTNU, and produced by Nordic VLSI. And the memory in this chip can retain data for over 20 years at 85 degrees Celsius, or 100 years at 25 degrees Celsius, with a probability of data loss for less than one part per million during that time. So it is kind of like they can retain data for quite a long time. And as you see here, it's a very low power usage. It's 0.2 milliamperes when active and 0.75 microamperes when in power save mode. So it's a factor of 10 between active and power save mode. Or 100, 100 actually, a factor of 100. And other more popular kind of architectures are, for example, 8051 architecture that was kind of like very old and very common everywhere. especially in low power system. You have ARM, have modern 32 or 64 bit reduced instruction set reduced instruction set computer with like most phones use this ARM architecture these days. And then you have ARC architecture, like you typically used on system on chips, sells about 1.5 billion per year. And as an example, well, this is an old example, so that was while still hard drives were was not solid state devices, but had these rotating platters. They contain 80 an 8051 processor and two ARM cores plus memory and so on. So the hard drive itself has computing power, but that is also true for SSD disks. The controller itself on the disk is kind of its own computer or embedded system. Then over to mobile phones. We have different generations when we talk about the mobile network, like everything from 1G, that was the analog network. Then you have the 2G network with GSM or CDMA in the US. You got kind of 3G, 4G, and today it's like 5G that is kind of rolled out and have started to gain popularity. And of course, the 6G that is they have started working on now should be even better, faster, stronger than the 5G network. And now they're talking about like terahertz span, really high frequency, a higher frequency on radio signal means that you can have a higher bandwidth available. But on the other hand, it's also more easily blocked by objects, so kind of you need more line of sight and smaller cells. So, and that was kind of the reason behind this picobases and femtocells in the 5G network also. And 5G also brought us support for IoT, more IoT specific transmission protocols. So, and then you have mobile phones also not only consist of the radio band, but also the operating system running on them. So you have various proprietary OSs for kind of cheap non-smartphones. An old one is ISA for Nokia phones and so on. So, and many of the really low-cost phones have their own kind of proprietary operating system running on them. Then you of course have Android, and this is smartphones from many different manufacturers. They typically run ARM, have a Linux kernel, but not Linux user land. You have iOS, popular operating system, and Apple hardware. Well, you had Windows Phone from Microsoft, but that is discontinued. You might see in a case where, like, what's typically in criminal cases that we see old equipment that we have to look at. So, in cases you might still see Windows Phone phones, mobile phones, but they're not sold anymore. And the same with BlackBerry OS. It was a company called Research in Motion that was making this, but as they couldn't ca catch up with the competition, they started selling Android phones with their own kind of security layer on top of it. But they quit doing that, and now they typically deliver security services instead. Then you have Tizen or Tizen or something I'm not sure how it's actually pronounced from Samsung. It's typically used in Samsung smartwatches, and some cameras use it, and a few phones from Samsung. But kind of most phones from Samsung are Android though, and other are Harmony OS from Huawei, Fuchsia from Google, and there's probably a lot more that I haven't gotten into this list. So on top of the operating systems, you have applications running that are in that kind of the operating system itself isn't that particularly interesting. What is interesting is the applications running on top of this or this operating system. And that is kind of messaging app. They handle the SMS and MMS messages, or camera apps that takes photos, WhatsApp messaging over IP network, and also other apps that users install are interesting, like encrypted notes, Tinder, Yodel. It's many apps that can be of interest in an investigation. And in a phone, like when you want to connect to the network, you need a subscriber identity module that contains the keys for authentication and encryption of the traffic over the mobile network. What we call a SIM card today is actually called a UICC, a universal integrated chip card, I think it's acronym. In 3G networks and later, this UICC card can also run applications from the SIM card itself. SIM card contains storage for contacts and SMSs, but it's very limited. So most phones today don't really use this SIM card for storing anything. You can, in most cases, tell the phone that I want this to be stored on the SIM card, but for most part, it's kind of automatically stored in the phone's memory instead. These days, you also see phones and equipment without the UICC. You use an eSIM module instead. It's an embedded SIM that don't use have this physical card, but you can kind of provision it remotely. You can set it up remotely from the telephone provider or mobile phone provider. So the mobile networks, I can say a little bit about was through this list of different generations of the networks, but a few important facts about kind of the network itself is that the mobile network has a kind of cell structure, and where each base station kind of creates a cell, a geographical cell that handsets connect to. So it's a mobile phone will typically then connect to the best base station. And base station has kind of one base station typically has antennas in three sectors that each cover about 120 degree. So we can check with which base station a mobile phone was or is connected to, and kind of can get a rough direction and maximum distance for the mobile phone where it is. And this info is updated even if the phone isn't used though. So as long as it's on, turned on, it will kind of update this information and connect to the base station. Kind of a mobile phone is often seen by many base stations at the same time, even though it's not connecting to more than one, it can be seen by several, and by kind of triangulating between base stations, we can find a probability for where the phone is located. But it's a caveat here because a phone doesn't need to be connected to the closest base station or the one with the best coverage. Because when I connect to a base station and I start moving, then my phone will continue to be connected to the same base station until the connection strength is below a certain threshold, and then it will update and connect to a new base station, even though I might move into areas where other base stations are stronger. I still am connected to the old one just because the signal hasn't gone below the threshold. So, and also it might be local variation because of kind of radio shadows and the distortions that kind of makes the base station that's on the coverage map seems to be the closest one. It might be that the connection to that isn't so great at that particular place you're standing anyway, so you will connect to another one that is a little bit further away. So, and the phone has an identity as well. It's called an IMEI number. So even though the SIM card has its own kind of ID number, the phone handset itself has also its own ID number, so it can be tracked and identified even when you change SIM card in the phone. Mobile phones are also a point where malware can be. Malware is everywhere, and you have typically seen many kind of apps that kind of are Trojan in its kind of true meaning, that it seems to be a game or a app doing something useful for you, but in fact it's a Trojan that installs on the phone. Banking Trojans is one of these where kind of it will can kind of sniff on the SMS messages, for example, to find the two-factor authentication keys sent to you the phone. And it's also found in point of sales terminals. And a point of sale terminal is typically a PC with a cash register shell on top of it. And many large credit card thefts is from these point of sale terminals. So Target was targeted by an attack like this. Credit card terminals are often targeted for swiping also, kind of where they will record the card number of any cards that are connected there. Like skimming, it's also called, in cases where kind of a store has seen a break-in, they see broken glass, they see someone has been inside, but nothing is stolen. And instead, the credit card terminals has been tampered with and installed this hardware skimming device. There's also malware that have infected equipment at the manufacturer. Might be an accident, might be an inside job. So, and like as a side note, you can hide malware in hardware. It's kind of if you are able to infect the computer that are designing a chip, for example, then you can also embed some malicious electronics inside there. It would be difficult to find, and it's its own research topic on both how to make hardware that are not easily tampered with at the production stage, and also how to hide malware inside this hardware. Then I can say a little bit about collection. Just needs a little bit of water. So in a book I presented as kind of a mental model, I called it an ontology there because it's kind of about how to connect the or it's a taxonomy of the acquisition methods, but also how they connect to the data you're going to acquire. It's a help for categorizing and selecting acquisition method. It's kind of it doesn't inf in itself it doesn't exist any bad or good methods. It depends on the context you're in. Sometimes kind of what we think about as forensically sound, you shouldn't change anything. You should take the more volatile or acquire and collect the more volatile data before the less volatile data and so on. And that's kind of a good kind of thing to aim for. But when you're on a crime scene, for example, you don't necessarily have the option of kind of doing everything on the most forensically sound method from a technical point of view, because you find a dead body, you find a phone there. Are you going to send the phone to the laboratory and get answer after 2 weeks about, or maybe a month about what messages was on it, who was the last one person it was called, and so on? Or are you going to check the phone on the scene of crime just to see whether it's something that can lead you to the killer there, for example? So, in most cases, that is the right thing to do because it helps you can help you solve the case better, even if it means that you're kind of changing the data on the phone. So it's kind of everything depends on the context, though. So you have in one way you have the data view where you can kind of think about the what type of data are you after, what is the information that is important in the case. At what abstraction layer is the data present? For example, if you think that there's something useful in the messages sent, then you might look at the content of the messages. It's a very high abstraction layer. But on the other hand, if you are kind of think that this phone has been used kind of for sending like a Trojan on the phone has sent malicious SMSs to others, then you might be want to have the data at a lower abstraction layer and kind of which method is depend you select is depending on what type of abstraction layer it is able to acquire data at. You can also think about the trust of the underlying system because kind of like if it's a security camera that has captured like a break-in or a car passing, then you might trust the system quite well because for example, the suspect hasn't had control over the hardware. So you can trust the data quite reasonably well there. On our other hand, if this is the phone that is caught from a suspect that is highly technical, then he might have tampered with something on the phone, have some kind of kill switch on it or anything, and kind of you don't really trust the underlying system as much as in the former case. And also, of course, how long do the data exist there? Is it data that will go away really fast, or will the data stay there for a long time? All this is kind of important factors that you have to consider when kind of determining which method you want to use for acquiring. And then you have the abstraction, the method view. That is kind of you kind of see which abstraction layer do the method acquire data from, How does it alter the data on the system? Is it repeatable? Can you do the same operation twice on a device and get the exact same result, or will the result differ every time you do this extraction? What is the cost of the acquisition? Because, well, no investigation is without limits to the resources you can use, and some costs are thing you have to do up front. Some are the costs that is kind of the resource usage you will use for during the acquisition or during the collection of data, and some are on the post-acquisition work or the examination. And like this, some methods might be really fast to do, but you need to do a lot of after work. Some might cost a lot up front, but kind of are easy to use later. And in the example here, I have kind of like assessed this in a spider diagram with a like where I have printed a chip-off method versus a manual inspection. And the orange line here shows the manual inspection, and the blue line shows the chip-off method. And kind of a manual inspection of a device is on a very high level layer of abstraction. That might be okay. It might be that the data is not present there anyway, so you shouldn't select this particular method. And of course, a chip-off method where you desolder the device and go and read out the chip memory is of course on a very low layer. And then a physical alteration. You won't physically alter the device as much with a manual inspection. You have to be careful with the fingerprints and all this, of course, but in most part you don't like kind of alter it physically much. While a chip-off, then you basically kind of take off electronics, and it will be a physical alteration. But the logical alteration isn't so high on the chip-off method, while it is high on the manual inspection, because every time you press a button, you will kind of write to the device. And of course, repeatability is kind of high for the, or it should be high for the chip-off method, and they're high for the chip-off method and low for the manual inspection one. Cost is very high for the chip-off method because you need the equipment, you need training. It's kind of a lot you have to invest before you can do it, while the manual inspection doesn't cost anything up front. In acquisition, it's about the same. You use about the same amount of work going through, like doing the chip-off in a laboratory as you do as going through the phone manually. And afterwards, the chip-off is a little bit more costly with regards to resources, because you have to kind of figure out how the data is stored there. You have to figure out how to rebuild the databases or like reconstruct the data inside. While it's kind of reasonably high on the manual inspection, because there you have to kind of sit and report everything you saw and take photos of and have to write down the messages of importance and so on. So it's a kind of a lot of after work in both these methods. Let's see, also a bit faster. It's in a collection phase in a forensic process model that the mobile and embedded system forensics differ the most from ordinary computer forensics. An ordinary computer has devices that has well-defined and standardized interfaces. And it's even upgradable or fixable by the end user. You can insert a new hard disk from whatever like a company, because it uses the same SATA or ENMI protocol. You can put in RAM from most producers and so on. Embedded system are like kind of a little bit harder, because it's kind of they are not meant to be user repairable. It's kind of, it often says no user serviceable parts inside. And the interfaces aren't well standardized. You have a few standards, but kind of sometimes they have extended that standard or changed it a little bit. So how do we approach this problem? Well, we can start by reading the documentation. It's often it will give you an indication about what the system is meant to do, but it's often not exact. So you have to guess a little bit and have to like examine it yourself. So one of the examples in the book is there's this camera system that we examined. That it was kind of, it said that the it was continuously recording, but the retention time was only 7 days, and that was 2 days later than the, or 2 days before that 7 day period. That is 9 days ago. It was kind of an interesting moment in time, but since it only retained for 7 days, kind of it seemed that everything was lost. But the thing was that the ring buffers inside, they were the same size anyway, so they just recorded until the ring buffer was full anyway, and that was about 14 days. And the 7 days retention time was only a kind of a user interface setting that kind of gave you access to the last 7 days. So it didn't really affect the recording length, but it affected the user interface length that you could scroll back on. So in the manual it just told us that this setting would set the retention time, so it seemed that kind of data was not stored for more than 7 days, but in fact they were. Another thing we have to consider is that the device has to be isolated from networks, because kind of if anyone can connect to that device, it means that also it can be remotely wiped, for example. But also, when you take things off from the network, does it affect traces? One example there, I think I put it in the book, was that was an alarm central where kind of they cut the cable to the alarm control center and sent it into the laboratory. And on the laboratory, it was only they didn't know about the backup battery inside, so everything, like all memory inside there, was overwritten by a message that the main power was cut. So it's kind of, it was, you know, just so because they cut that power line or power to the alarm station, it wouldn't, it overwrote all the interesting messages that was inside there. So you could check what kind of storage could be in the device. Does it store anything at all? It's like something that looks like a PC peripheral can have its own storage. So it's kind of like, so it's not only a device itself that might have storage, but anything connected to it might also have storage. Is it any security measures there? Can it be circumvented in any way? So it's kind of like, should you keep it on so you still have access to the content, or should you, can you turn it off because you know you can circumvent this security measure anyway? Is there any ports or the protocols known? Is it any hidden kind of communication ports there? And of course, you have to kind of consider electrostatic discharge, because when you kind of physically take take on an object, like the potential, the difference in potential between you and the device may spark a current going through the. Through the device, to like from you through the device and to ground. So that's in itself is its whole science. So that's kind of basically try not to destroy the device by touching kind of exposed electronics. Many of the circuits that exist do have, or chips have kind of measures against electrostatic discharge. So it's not everything is ruined, but it's better safe than sorry in this regard. And of course, during a collection, you also need to record the physical state of the device. Is it broken? Is there any blood or bodily fluids on it? Sharp edges, chemical hazards? Is it on or off or sleeping? Is it powered? Does it have battery? And how much is left? Is the clock going correctly? And so on. And of course, one other thing to consider is, of course, other traces, other kind of forensic traces, fingerprints, DNA, tool markings. Is it anything you need to be careful about? Sometimes you might need to, for example, for a phone, you need to open the phone and only take out the electronics so you can see the electronics, but then you give the case to the other traditional forensic experts to look for fingerprints, DNA, tool markings, and so on that case. So it might, but be aware of this one at least. And I think I'll go through a couple of more slides and then take the bridge after the collection. I'm finished with the collection phase here. You have often a kind of flash-based embedded systems, and this is a kind of a generic diagram over any flash-based system. You have a processor with some RAM, and on this it's application running. You have an operating system, and operating system often have a driver either for a general purpose file system like X3 or X4, or a flash file system that is kind of looking at or kind of directly handling the flash itself. And if you use a general purpose flash system or file system that is not kind of created for flash, then you either need to have a interface to the raw flash device either through an external chip or through a controller on the flash memory chip itself. And if you have a flash translation layer in the operating system, then you can kind of use the raw flash device. And of course, for a flash FS, you don't need these interfaces, but you can just connect to the raw flash device. And then you have JTAG, it's a port for testing and programming the chips. So I will come back to that one. But basically, you have the processor, you have a interface either on its own chip or embedded in the flash memory, and then you have the raw flash. And this is typically what we're interested in, the raw flash here. There. So getting to the data, we could use an application or service running on the platform to get data. We can, for example, use the phone itself to check recently dialed numbers. We could connect to the phone or device from my computer and read the file system as a mass storage device or via media transfer protocol. And as a mass storage device, we see the embedded system itself as a block device. And as a if it's connected as a media transfer protocol, we only get access to the file, so you can do a file transfer, but not a kind of not a whole block device. We can read through the operating system. And like this often especially for phones, needs that the device is rooted or you have root access to the operating system. Then you could use JTAG to read through the flash controller and can sidestep the CPU completely. And we can also try to get the flash subsystem itself, kind of to get it as a USB stick inside the system. We could desolder the flash chip and read them directly, or we can kind of grind down the physical chips and look at them, look at the insides. But this is kind of very time consuming, and they need a lot of equipment. So for most investigations, that is out of the scope. So yeah, maybe we should have a break right now. What do you think? It's a few slides left on physical acquisition.
We can make a short break, perhaps. It's better.
I thought that to know is kind of like a good place as any. I thought that it was a little bit more slides on the acquisition than I had thought. So I think to have a little break now would probably help, and we can continue in, I don't know, how long a break do you need?
5, 10 minutes, what do you think? Like, what's your preference?
Yeah, if you say 10 past, start up at 10 past. So,
Yeah, sounds good. So we meet again at 15:10.
Then I just turn off the video and sound, and while I wait, I just let the yeah, I think just like 10 past 3 or so start. So then I come back in a few minutes, and of course I can see if there are any questions while I'm here. No questions in the chat at least, so. So I have to remember I'm on page 18. I'm about halfway now, so it was okay with a break. No problem, no problem. Hope it is understandable. That's good. That's good. Is it many students here at this semester at the course? So that's good. That's good. I just have to run out for a moment, so I'll be back in a few minutes. So see you soon. Perfect.
Right, welcome back. So we are ready for the second part. Please, Jens Petter, the floor is yours.
Ah, thank you. Yes, we're back again, and we were in acquisition mode now, collection of evidence. Let's see, a short recap from last was we went through the ways of acquiring the memory. And then we can look at a little bit at my physical acquisition. It's reading the memory directly from that kind of physical interface. And we can discern between two ways of doing this, either through like an in vivo or in vitro, that is kind of terminology borrowed from biology, basically. It's kind of in vivo means in the flesh, kind of, or getting the data as the system are on are in the system, or in vitro, that means on a dish, or kind of taking out the memory and reading it out from outside the system. So like typically these are done with the chip off for the latter case in vitro, and the test ports for the former case, where kind of we can read through either JTAG or some other system we can connect to the ENMC interface or anything. Chip off, that is kind of easy. You remove the chip and you read the contents, but there are some more to it. It might be complicated to get the chip actually off the board. Is it potted? Is there like epoxy glue over the whole chip? Then it's kind of hard to. You can't desolder it. You have to kind of get rid of this glue, this epoxy glue on top of it. Is it solder? Is it just lead-based solder, lead-free solder? Is there underfill? That is kind of some glue used under the chip when it's soldered on to keep the chip in place. And if it's that, then it might not be enough to just heat up the chip in order to desolder the tin there. And kind of the package itself is basically two form factors. You have a TSOP and BDA. TSOP is where you have the small legs on the sides. And BGA is a ball grid array where you have a kind of small balls underneath the chip that are kind of soldered to a grid of this solder lens on the PCB. And for desoldering the TSO package, Here we are. Yes. Yeah, I think it was network on this side that suddenly fell out. Just suddenly realized that it everything stopped here, so.
We continue with the presentation now.
Yeah, how far did I get? Did I get to the people? Okay, I know, at least I didn't talk so long for myself. Oh, and I will share my screen here again. See. Here we are. Here we are. I hope you can see my screen again. Ah, that's good. That's good. Oh, yeah, then I continue. Sorry for that network glitch there. It's So I'm not sure exactly where I fell out here, but kind of when you're desoldering, you have kind of like two basic type of chips. One is a T-SOP with the legs kind of on the side of the package, and it's kind of like in order to desolder this, you have to kind of heat up everything at once because you don't want to heat up one side and bend it up and then heat the other side because that might ruin the both the chip itself and or the legs on the chip at least and the PCB it's soldered to. So you need to heat up everything. You need special. You do typically with a specialized tip that kind of like lets the kind of desolder both sides at the same time. BGA it has contacts on the underside of the chip package, and this need to kind of heat up the whole chip in order to kind of desolder it. And to be able to read out afterwards, you need either to then reball the chip, or that means to solder tiny solder balls on this this bottom of the BGA package again, or use something called pogo pins that are kind of a socket with kind of like a mounted like small pins in order to get a good connection between the flash reader and the flash chip itself. Temperature is very important when soldering and desoldering. Because kind of materials, when they heat up, they expand, and they expand at different rates. So you want to be sure that they don't expand too fast away from each other. So that's the thing. You want to increase the temperature slow and steady. A rule of thumb is that the core temperature shouldn't increase more than 3 degrees per second. So, this is kind of often called a process window, but the amount of heat and you can apply to the chip and for how much time and so on. Then you addition have something called a phase change memory. That is memory that will actually be ruined when you heat it up. So when you desolder a PCM or a phase shift memory, a phase change memory, then you will kind of reset the memory by the heating process. And if it's kind of used any epoxy or glue in any way to this, then kind of it's not enough to just heat it up. You need to kind of either remove the glue mechanically or remove them or chemically first. So it's a lot of chemicals that are kind of solvents that are kind of targeted toward a specific type of epoxy, so it's kind of not really interchangeable between different types of glue either. So two different techniques, desoldering I talked about. Another way is lapping, or kind of a very, very fine grinder, where you kind of just put you will of course you ruin the PCB. You take away, or you use the saw just to get a small part of the PCB around the chip you want to, and then you use this lapping machine to grind off the PCB layer by layer until you have only the chip left, like here. This needs kind of of course, some specialized tools. You can't do this with just sanding paper and and try, or you can try though. But I think the process will be safer and easier with a lapping machine. And of course, for reading the chips, you can use kind of how to get the memory out of the chip when you have the actual chip there. One way is to use kind of chip programmers, or they are not made for forensics, so they're made for programming the chip, for kind of putting data into the chip before it's soldered on surface, soldered on a PCB. For example, to put firmware on it, or like this, you know, so it's not created to, but it can read out the content also, but it's not its main purpose. So therefore, it is also we have to be careful with the settings so we don't accidentally write over the memory. And the Netherlands Forensic Institute, they have made one like this flash reader for forensic use called the Memory Toolkit. And kind of I have a just a picture of it on the bottom here. So yeah, so here's some figures from the TIPO process. We have a USB stick with four TSOP packages here, one on each side of this PCB and one on each side of this PCB. Here we have an infrared soldering machine that is kind of desoldering from a mobile phone. And here's a BGA chip. You see all these small soldering balls on the bottom here. And then we have I think this one actually is from the forensic toolkit. You see the pogo pins here, and like this is the pogo pins. They are have small pins protruding from each side, and it's kind of a spring inside, so they will give a good connection even if it's not 100% even surface. Sorry. Ah, there. And yeah, so this is some of the equipment used for chip-off. And another way is to use kind of in vivo type of acquisition. The Joint Test Action Group specified or had a specification for a kind of system in order to use it for boundary scans. It was created in 1990, called I can only refer to as JTAG. It was originally a way to test if there were a trace between two points, test points or a boundary scan originally was a way to test the PCB or the electronics board, that it was connection between test pads on the board. It was a manual way, and it was a kind of a very time-consuming, and it was also an error prone, because if you didn't kind of if it weren't, you could miss some test points and like this, and ship off a system that didn't actually meet the quality criteria. But with JTAG, you could just place a connector there, and it would automatically test the board for a connection. And now You even has we have extended this JTAG system to also be inside the chip, so you can read the kind of both testing the electronics on the outside, but also in use it inside the chips, or kind of to program or without memory from this. It can be used to find defects on the board. It can be used to find defects on the core logic on integrated circuits. It can be used for programming programmable logic, including reading back existing programs there. In circuit programming, before you had kind of to program the chips and then set it into the system, but now you can do it while they are in the system all the time. You can use it to send signals to other peripheral devices, or you can use it for debugging. And the last two are kind of most interesting to us. It enables us to kind of run the flash memory as if it were the CPU in X test mode, or use the debug mode of the CPU to read out the flash memory. Kind of the first X, this X test mode, it's kind of like a very slow method, so it's kind of like it's not used that much, but the debug mode is much more interesting. JTAG in itself is a standardized interface with 5 pins. You have test data in, you have test data out, those are serially connected. You have a clock, you have a module select, and you have a reset. And here you have kind of a system, kind of how the JTAG system looks. You have this tap, this state machine. And then you have an instruction register that kind of you can use. You have a bypass register for when you just want to bypass this chip, device ID. And then you have these pads for disconnecting the core logic of the system. So this TDI on TDO, the test data in and out, they are daisy chained. Like in this figure here, you see I have can or it can be daisy chained. So you can have kind of several components on the same JTAG chain. And today, typically, it's only one device on a JTAG chain, but in principle, you can have several on the same chain. So is everything roses and rainbows? No, it was too much copyright violations and kind of this thing going on. So there are security measures in place. So ports, the JTAG ports can be hidden, or it can be made with fusible links. So after it's tested and verified that the board works, they will just break the fuses. So it's not usable anymore, or you even can have a kind of security protocols to the JTAG interface that means that you need to have a keyword or a password in order to access it. So JTAG is kind of a little bit higher level than CPoF, but not that much. You can kind of read the flash memory directly, and you can bypass the operating system. And it's much quicker and more convenient than CPoF. If it works out, you don't need that much equipment for doing a JTAG acquisition. So it's kind of like, in some ways, it's preferable, but unfortunately, not all systems support this. So sometimes it's a bit difficult to draw the line between a physical and logical acquisition because kind of hardware isn't necessarily so hard anymore. A flash translation layer, for example, hides pages from us. Even if you're actually using a physical interface like a SATA interface and read it from a SATA interface like a SATA disk, the flash translation layer will hide unused or broken pages from us, so we don't see them at all using this interface. So it's kind of, even though we think about kind of connecting a SATA disk to a write blocker and acquiring it as a physical readout, you actually get the process data. So it's kind of a type of logical output also. So these are often called a pseudo physical acquisition, but we can also call them kind of in between physical and logical acquisition methods. Then we go on to using the go to a little bit higher abstraction layer and using the operating system itself for reading out data, but then we will need the root access, and the protection in mobile operating systems are more complex than in a normal Unix system, even though it's kind of the Linux kernel running there. Each process runs in its own sandbox and running as its own user without root privileges. So if we can get root access, we can also read the raw block devices and kind of do the a DD acquisition, a disk dump of the raw block device. But as I said, it might not give us everything. And in order to become root, we often need to rely on bugs in the operating system, like local privilege escalation attacks and this type of exploits, in order to get into the position to become a root. Another way is to kind of use the boot sequence of the operating system to kind of boot from an alternative device. It's almost like booting from a CD-ROM or from a USB stick, and without the disk from the or system running on the USB disk. And in order to do this, you need to boot the device into a device firmware upgrade mode, like called a DFU mode, or a recovery mode, it's also called, where you can flash a custom boot image. And when you boot that, you can do what you want or need. But most often, sometimes you can also read write partitions from the recovery mode directly, which means that you don't really have to boot an OS at all. But providers want to prevent ordinary users from rooting their own phones because it's a security issue, and therefore they also have secured the boot process. So by unlocking the bootloader, they often will give you access to unlocking the bootloader, but the cost is that you erase the user partition in the device. So from a forensic point of view, you will lose the data you want to acquire or collect. So we are back to hunting bugs, basically, to let us in, unless it's a technically inclined person that has chosen to install or root his own phone himself, though, or kind of installed a new operating system. So most phones today, I say in the slides, it says many phones, but today it's most phones, use encrypted storage by default. You don't get a question to if you want a encrypted storage or not. It's just encrypted by default. Keys are in a secure computing module, and you can't read out the keys from it. You can only write new keys to it, or more correctly, you can only say to it that it should generate new keys, so you don't really see the keys itself. A reset will wipe the keys, and the bootloader trick won't work either, as we will need to authenticate to the secure processing component in order to help us decrypt the data. And factory reset in this phone won't actually delete or overwrite any data. It will just throw away the encryption key. So it's kind of like it's without encryption key, we don't have anything, basically. And when it comes to application, kind of the operating system itself is one thing, but kind of applications might also use encrypted storage. And if they implement this themselves, it is often riddled with bugs. Like key generation is often not that secure. The random number generation well, you see the random number generator with time now, for example, and give us a very predictable seed to the random number generator, and a lot of those mistakes are being done. Getting cryptographic implementations right are not easy if you're not an expert, and even for experts, it's not easy. So, and it's a growing standardization of Flash where it's on an eMMC interface, and without FD, Flash translation layer, and it looks more like a normal disk. It's called a managed Flash device because the FTL and the Flash controller is on the Flash storage itself, and the operating system doesn't have to deal with the VR leveling or anything that is Flash specific. The eMMC is an interface that builds on the MMC card standard, and so if we desolder that types of chips, we can just plug them into an MMC reader and kind of read out just like a disk. There exist other flash managed flash storage technologies such as universal flash storage, UFS, and embedded USB. But is it a physical acquisition? It falls in this in between type of acquisition. It's kind of it looks like a physical acquisition, but it's in fact processed data we get out of it, or a pseudo-physical. RAM isn't that well studied in embedded systems. It's more difficult to access it and to read it, and the devices themselves are often made to be restarted often, and hence not that dependent on RAM. They are made so that batteries can fall out, and you don't really lose that much data. So, and that means the more is stored on flash, the more often, the more kind of security is against kind of power failures and so on. Even stuff from running processes are often found in flash. So, but still, it is kind of it might be interesting data there, and we can use JTAG to read RAM. We can boot with a new firmware that doesn't reset RAM if we were able to do this, like in cold boot attacks and like this. And we can use a running OS like in computer forensics, but also this requires root access though. So, and then a word about damaged devices. It's kind of often we will come over or come across like damaged devices, either devices that has been like damaged by accident, but often they are kind of destroyed on purpose. But it's surprisingly difficult to kind of to ruin a device in such a way that all data is lost in it. It's kind of if there it's thrown into a fire, the fire is often not hot enough to kind of ruin the electronics, and kind of the if you for example put in a phone in a fire, the plastic will melt and kind of insulate the chips in the package, so the temperature inside the chips will not rise as fast and not as high as the flames themselves. Water might short out devices, like you get the electric kind of the electricity might not kind of you won't be able to power on the device because of short-circuited the device has been short-circuited, but the chips themselves, you don't get water into the chips, so it's just kind of the surface of the device that is damaged, and kind of it's been recorded that in fresh water, a device that has been in water for 2 years have still recoverable flash memory, and in salt water for several months. And the thing is, when you want to acquire, or if you find a device that are soaked in water, you want to remove the device with the water. You want to keep the device in the same water it was found until you get to the laboratory where you can properly clean it at once. Because when you take it, the oxidation process needs oxygen, well, basically to start working. And while there is a little bit oxygen in the water, it's much more in the air. So when you take it out in the air, the oxidation process will start, and it will damage much more than if you just keep it in the water until you're in the laboratory and can clean it properly with clean water and some isopropyl alcohol or something. So, and the third thing is that mechanical damage is also surprisingly hard. The chip itself is kind of the silicon chip itself is really hard to kind of ruin properly. You can damage the connections, but kind of those connections can be re-soldered, or kind of you can do other things to get the connection back. So it's like it says here rebond. That means that you kind of put like really thin wires on those connectors. Yeah, you might have to kind of decap the chip, or kind of get into the chip to get the connections right, but it's still the chip might be still be there. And photo here you see a phone that has been tried shot, and here the square here was where the memory chip was located, and that was we were able to read that even if the phone itself had been shot with a 9 millimeter. And then, so examination in order to do properly examine like the memory dump or the memory from a device like this, you need to learn a little bit about how what flash is and how that works, because a flash system uses or most embedded system uses flash storage. Flash translation layer, erase blocks, and so on. File systems that works with the flash, like yet another flash file system. And of course, the application and how they store the data. And Android apps typically store it in SQLite databases. Apple products store data in plists. And for example, raw SMS messages, that's not as common now as it was before, but still. Many system uses SMS for communicating, and this raw SMS PDUs can be found in mobile phones. For flash memory, it is two types of flash. We have NAND flash or NOR flash, and NAND flash is the most common used for kind of user data and this type of thing. NOR flash is not that much used anymore. It's kind of takes more space and it's more expensive. But it also can retain data much longer, and it's was typically used for firmware. Now you typically just put the firmware on a NAND flash anyway. So, and the special thing about NAND flash is that we only can change a one to a zero, so we can like change one ones into zeros, but in order to change a zero to one, you have to erase a whole block of pages. So we can't erase individual bytes back to one, but we can set individual bytes from one to zero, and that means we have to handle the writing like in a particular way. We can't kind of like just update a file. If you want to update a file, you can, as long as you just append to a file, you can do it, because you can just like switch the ones down to zeros. But if you want to kind of change a value inside a file, you have to copy the contents into a new page. A page is typically 512 or 2048 bytes, and erase block sizes can be from a few pages and up to hundreds of pages. Samsung K9 chip that you can just use as an example here has a 8 kilobyte page and a 1 megabyte erase block. So in order to erase a value, you need to erase 1 megabytes of data. And we can't even write indefinitely. We can typically only erase write a block 100,000 times before it's kind of it's on the end of the life. So that means we have to do rear leveling. We have to kind of make sure that the file system don't write to one particular page all the time. We have to spread the writing across as many pages as possible. So we have to reallocate kind of pages and make sure that that they don't only hit one particular size, and that is the flash translation layer that is doing this. So for us, it looks like like on the top of the flash translation layer, it looks like one address area, but on the bottom, it's a lot of small patches that are kind of the data are stored in. So it will do a lot of copying to change only a couple of bytes. When we read a chip from chip off, it might be difficult to know which is the live data and which is the kind of leftover from a previous version of the data. So I was kind of like, sorry. I was mentioning this earlier when looking at the kind of embedded system. But there's like three ways of organizing the storage. With an ordinary disk, you have the operating system, you have a file system driver, and a block device. You can have an ordinary file system with an FTL. Very many of today's phones typically have this because the FTL is on the chip, on the flash chip itself. But you have the operating system, you have a file system driver, for example, X4, and then you have the flash translation layer and the raw flash device. And if you use a flash file system, a file system that is specifically made to be used on flash devices, then you have the operating system, you have the file system driver that contains rear leveling mechanism and bad block management, and you have the raw flash device. So like I said, after 100,000 writes, a page is typically at the end of the life, but it might fail much before that. So therefore the flash translation layer also have to handle those bad blocks and kind of exchange that address area with new blocks that are kept in backup. So every NAND flash chip has a lot of blocks that are not used but are kind of backup for the bad blocks, so they kind of will exchange the new blocks for the bad blocks. Flash file system. We can look a little bit. The book looks a little bit into YAFS 2 file system. It's a log structured file system. It's a great file system for Flash because it doesn't change anything. It just appends a new version on writes like kind of to the end of the file system. So every time you change a file, it will just append the newest version to the end of the file system, basically. And when you come to the end of the file system, or you don't have any more free space left, then you do a garbage collection to free up unused blocks. And the garbage collection, it works by that it will go through and put like half used pages. Or a half used erase blocks where kind of just it's a few active pages, they will put that together in new unused erase blocks, and then you free up as many erase blocks as possible, and then you erase them and they can use that for new storage. The Coffee file system is another flash file system. It's a bit simpler. It's used in Contiki OS for resource constrained devices. And it has a much simpler garbage collection because it doesn't reorder the pages. But the drawback with that particular file system is that if you have a lot of writes, you might end up, or and a lot of files that is written, you might end up with a file system that can't free up or there are not any free erase blocks left because you don't have the reordering done by ops. So it's mostly used in very simple systems with very few files. Carving for data in a flash file system or in a flash device might be it's as useful as in computer forensics. You are looking for a specific structure, for example, an SMS PDU that is a raw SMS message on the phone. That can be interesting, and to carve for databases might be interesting. And of course, if you have acquired the raw flash device, then you might have to rebuild the FTL into, or just as the FTL, you have to rebuild the pages into a file system or a logical address area that kind of contains the file system. Or if you have kind of acquired it through a pseudo-physical method, then you might have the whole file system and you just need to go through and carve like you would do in an ordinary way. Timestamps is interesting to carve for. One example in the book was that our database that listed connected networks, download apps, and so on. We saw that the clock was running normally and suddenly it jumped 1 hour back. So the kind of consecutive log lines suddenly kind of had double timestamps for 1 hour. And that, or 24 hours. And that was very interesting because kind of this all happened in a kind of very interesting time. Was the suspect working on their alibi? Or could it be caused by, for example, a battery falling out of the phone as claimed by the suspect? Suspect claimed that, oh no, I haven't changed the time, but the battery was really bad. It was falling out of the device all the time. And when I set it in, the clock was just kind of randomly set. I don't know. So that was his explanation to it. Could it be that that had happened, or was it that he had kind of on purpose set the time back 24 hours? Of course, after what we initially thought was that he had set back the phone or the time on the phone, but kind of we couldn't rule out that the clock had jumped because when we tested, we saw that it actually was possible for a clock to jump like randomly in time when something happened, so or when the battery failed. So it's kind of it was an interesting case. So summary, the IoT systems are pretty much like a computer system. They are kind of low power, small size, restricted user interfaces. They have kind of different ports, kind of some proprietary, some standardized. It's usually hard to get to the stored information on a computer system, and it's kind of less established methods for kind of a forensically sound acquisition. And the important thing is kind of document what you're doing, when and why. Remember the basics, kind of with evidence integrity and chain of custody. What did you do? What data do you think you changed? Who has been changing this data? It's a little bit more risky to handle a computer, both for the personnel and for the device. You can ruin the device, but you can also kind of it's used in more hostile environments, so you can damage yourself also. And flash storage. It has flash storage memory soldered to the PCB, not kind of memory chips that you can just disconnect. But computers also start to look more like mobile devices. You have like this ultra compact or ultra mobile PCs that are kind of like has solder on RAM on the PCB of the board. You have soldered on memory or flash memory. So it's kind of like So some PCs also start to look more like the embedded system than or mobile devices than so a few years ago. So that was my presentation. I hope you got something useful out of it. And I think I was kind of caught on time also.
Thank you very much, Jens Petter. Really interesting presentation, very detailed. I can see the challenges when it comes to, let's say, analyzing the data from all these devices and having all these different formats and different types of memories. It's definitely a lot of work, when it comes to analysis of like variety of devices. Yes, any questions? Anyone in the room or online?
I didn't see anything on the chat yet, at least.
Anyone?
Was perfectly clear.
Yeah, definitely. I can repeat the soldering process.
How do embedded systems keep any timestamp information? Was on Ranvir asked on the chat, and some do, and some don't. It is very dependent because most processing units have an internal clock running, and some has synchronized it with the kind of local time or UTC, mostly local time, or not mostly local time, but some kind of small embedded system that are not network connected typically has kind of are set to some local time, some without any user interface, just that has just a few kind of maybe a LED lights and buttons to operate, and don't necessarily keep any kind of. They have an internal clock, but it's not synchronized to the kind of to the local time. It's just a clock counting up from when it started. So even if it's not, you don't find kind of the local time there, the like time in like in a time like the 2022 10th or 11th of October at 2:30, you will find the number of seconds or number of ticks running from the from it has been booted. And for more. For network connected devices, they typically will contain a clock or times or have time information in the operating system and keep track of time and thereby also have in their logs have timestamp information. And it is impossible to access this just like we would in any other computer system, basically. So yeah, because this is stored in